This is David Duke. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of vital importance to Europeans and people of European descent, no matter where they may live upon the earth. And certainly this program is important for all peoples and all cultures, all heritages, because all of us want to be free. All of us want to control our own destiny. All of us who are concerned about freedom and the preservation of our heritage and way of life are opposed to so-called globalism. And we're also opposed to the world's most virulent racial supremacism, and that's called Jewish supremacism. Today is an exciting day in the sense that I begin the very last chapter of my book, Jewish Supremacism in the Spoken Word. It's the 14th chapter, and it deals with Jewish claims of superiority and deals with some final thoughts about this overriding danger facing all the people of the world. The Jewish supremacists are literally driving us toward what they call World War IV. That's what their neocons call it. They've got America into a disastrous war in Iraq. They're destabilizing the world. Their so-called war on terror is only creating more terror and hatred. It's creating a massive clash of civilizations. And this book, very bravely, I think, deals with these issues. I think you'll be fascinated and shocked by the data that's in this book. And by the way, all of the citations in this book can be found in my printed edition. And it's also available in an online downloadable edition. So, ladies and gentlemen, let's go ahead and get started. This is indeed chapter 14, the final chapter of Jewish supremacism, the very first part. Here we go. Chapter 14, Jewish Evolutionary Strategy and Claims of Jewish Superiority. In the early 1970s, a period of rampant egalitarianism, I read The Geography of Intellect by Jewish partisans Nathaniel Weil and Stefan Pozny, and also a popular book called The Jewish Mystique by Ernest von den Haag. They claimed outright that Jews were genetically, culturally, and morally superior. They said brazenly what the mainstream Jewish histories had implied. In 1969, popular British scientist turned novelist C.P. Snow gave a speech to Hebrew Union College in which he claimed that because of inbreeding, Jews were, quote, superior to all other living peoples, unquote. Then as now, in explaining Jewish success, some Jewish authors suggest that the structure of Judaism had a positive genetic effect on intelligence. Assertions of Jewish genetic superiority enjoy a warm reception by the same media that caustically condemn as immoral and evil what they call, quote, the theory of Caucasian genetic superiority. Weil argued persuasively that Jewish traditions had a genetic eugenic effect, citing the fact that the most successful Jewish scholars and thus the most intelligent in the Jewish community, the rabbis, were supported by their fellow Jews in having the largest families. He compared the high rabbinic birth rate to the celibacy of the Catholic clergy, which he felt had a dysgenic effect among Gentiles. I could certainly see how such reproductive patterns would be beneficial to Jewish intelligence, and I was certainly willing to acknowledge that Jews are intelligent. What struck me then was Weil's thesis that Jewish social patterns and practices could affect their intelligence. I had long believed that both intelligence and behavioral tendencies have an important genetic component, but for the first time, I began to think seriously about the underlying differences between Jews and Gentiles. Were they cultural, religious, or genetic in origin? To get at the bottom of it, I looked at applications of evolutionary biology to the development of the Jewish people. Charles Darwin's The Origin of Species dealt with the effects of natural selection on individuals, but even more importantly, on the selection process involving species and subspecies, races. He studied the origin of groups of genetically related individuals and studied their fitness to survive in respective environments. The subtitle for Darwin's masterpiece reads, "Or the Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life." Few understood the mechanism of group selection in regard to human revolution. Perhaps the best early exposition of it was Sir Arthur Keith's dynamic 1948 book, A New Theory of Human Evolution. Keith explained that just as individuals are subject to evolutionary pressures, so are competing groups. In the early 1960s, researcher W.D. Hamilton and others began the modern inquiries into the genetic basis of social behavior, now referred to as sociobiology. The principles of sociobiology, first propounded by G.C. Williams in the 1960s, became scientifically embedded in the principles of behavioral genetics and in the landmark work of Dr. Edward Wilson in his seminal Sociobiology, A New Synthesis. I read Wilson's book just a few months after it came out and found it magnificent. Although Wilson deftly sidestepped the application of his theories to the human races, he offered powerful evidence that behavior in most elementary creatures, such as ants, had a biological basis driven by the urge to preserve the genotype. Genetic kinship turned out to be a powerful factor in evolution and behavior. In such a context, group loyalty and altruism became understandable from an evolutionary perspective in that the individual may sacrifice even his life and his individual reproduction to ensure the survival of those who are genetically similar to him. Richard Alexander, J. Philippe Rushton, D. S. Wilson, Kevin MacDonald, Edward Wilson, Edward Miller, and many others over the next two decades pushed the envelope further. They showed that human groups differing in their genetic makeup experience similar social pressures to those experienced by competing animal species or subspecies. The new scientific discipline called behavioral genetics and evolutionary psychology continues to break new ground, showing the ultimate relationship between heredity and human behavior on both the individual and the group level. The insights of sociobiology and behavioral genetics greatly increased our understanding of the development of racial differences. It's easy to understand the evolutionary impact of the harsh northern climate on more than 5,000 generations of Europeans, and the effects of the milder climate in Africa on the black race. In addition, the social taboos, customs, and social organization of human beings since the beginnings of civilization can also have an obvious impact on reproductive patterns and genetic makeup. Since the relatively recent domestication of the dog, mankind has produced, through selective breeding, over 130 different breeds of dog that differ as much as the Saint Bernard, the hairless Chihuahua, the German Shepherd, and the Pug. All of them come from one original species, and all are genetically capable of interbreeding just as different human races are. Here's how Grolier's Encyclopedia characterizes the varieties of dog and how selective breeding has affected both appearance and temperament. Quote, "Dogs vary more in outward appearance than in anatomical structure. An adult dog may weigh 2 to 99 kilograms, 4 to 220 pounds, depending on the breed, and range in height from 12.5 to 90 centimeters, 5 to 35 inches at the shoulder. Other differences in conformation include length of leg, length of muzzle, size and attitude of ears, length, shape, and carriage of the tail, and length, density, color, and character of the hair. Over time, the various breeds were also selectively bred to produce temperaments suited to the tasks they performed." In the same way that people could selectively breed genetically different breeds of dogs, certain social structures and policies can obviously affect human evolution. Social structures, especially those that influence marriage patterns, could have a dramatic impact on survival and reproduction rates. They could certainly affect human temperament and behavior in the same way that dog breeders have created breeds as stoic as the Saint Bernard or as hyperactive as the Pekingese. We all know people who are naturally as aggressive as a pit bull or as friendly as a Labrador retriever. Is the Jewish behavioral pattern a product of cultural institutions such as Judaism and its secular offspring Zionism, or is there something in the genotype that inclines them to consistent behaviors that they've exhibited across greatly differing cultures over three millennia? I wondered how the structure and nature of Judaism across the centuries may have affected the genetic characteristics of the Jewish people. Just as two species of animals occupying a particular geographic area naturally develop a group evolutionary strategy to compete for resources, so human groups can do the exactly same thing. Even in the civilized societies, this can happen. They can develop certain behavioral traits that give them competitive advantages and greater reproductive success. In human societies, when genetically distinct groups interact, they can assimilate and lose their genetic distinctions, or they can develop ethnocentric ideologies and behavior that favor the distinct characteristics of their own gene pool. An ethnocentric group could even develop a religion that rationalizes its evolutionary response to these other groups. I wondered if the Jews had become genetically distanced from the other peoples of Europe, and if so, how deep the divide was. Had their supremacist and ethnocentric tendencies become ingrained in their genetic code, or were they simply a result of the cultural attitude of their religion and the separate societies they created? Did genetic impulses create the ideology of Judaism that reinforced and intensified the Jewish stereotype? Years later, in the 1990s, the same Jewish-dominated anthropology that rejected the importance of European racial consciousness and sense of identity has reasserted Jewishness and the Jewish identity. In Jews, Multiculturalism, and Boasian Anthropology, in the American anthropologist, Jewish writer Gayla Frank celebrates the American Boasian anti-racist anthropology as, quote, Jewish history. She then points out the central Jewish role was intentionally whitewashed for fear that Gentiles would realize that Jews had a racial agenda. Now, I'll quote here. There has always been a lively, if sometimes hushed, in-house discourse about American anthropology's Jewish origins and their meaning. The preponderance of Jewish intellectuals in the early years of Boasian anthropology and the Jewish identities of anthropologists in subsequent generations have been downplayed in standard histories of the discipline. This essay brings together strands of these various discourses on Jews and anthropology for a new generation of American anthropologists, especially ones concerned with turning multiculturalist theories into agendas for activism. There's also been a whitewashing of Jewish ethnicity, reflecting fears of anti-Semitic reactions that could discredit the discipline of anthropology and individual anthropologists, either because Jews were considered dangerous due to their presumed racial differences or because they were associated with radical causes. That's from Gayla Frank. Now, with the political and cultural dominance of racial pluralism over European solidarity, Frank discloses that Jewish anthropologists are reasserting their Jewish ethnicity and group identity. And again, I quote, any number of scholars are reasserting Jewishness in the academy, simultaneously attempting to discover and define what Jewish identity can mean in the most universalist of institutions. Some relevant examples from the long and growing list of sources, in addition to several already cited, include Bahar, 1996, Boyarian, 1992-1996, Eilberg Schwartz, 1990-1992-1994, Goldberg, 1987-1995, Klebat, 1996, Nocklin and Garb, 1995, Prell, 1989-1990-1996, Robin, Dorsky, and Fisher-Fishkin, 1996, and Schneider, 1995. The reappearance of Jewish differences raises the stakes for Jewish anthropologists engaged in multicultural discourses. Unquote. The article floored me. The same Jewish-driven anthropology establishment that tells Europeans and others that there's no such thing as race and racial identity, and that such thinking is silly at best and a moral evil at worst, quietly promotes Jewish differences and Jewish genetic identity. Frank's article goes on with unrestrained praise of the Jewish pride in the writings of Barbara Meyerhoff in Number Our Days. When I read this, it was hard for me to believe that it had appeared in the premier magazine of anthropology, a magazine that has and still does incessantly ridicule the idea of race and ethnic pride for Europeans. When I first looked into the issue of Jewish genetic relatedness, I did not have the benefit of Frank's article. At that time, I thought that the best way to investigate the issue was to see how similar the geographically separated Jewish populations are to each other and to the genetic Gentile populations among whom they live. Do Jews differ from other Europeans the same way that, say, an Englishman differs from a Frenchman, or, say, a German from a Russian? Are all they altogether different from all European subraces? Now, substantial work has been done on this issue, much of it from Jewish researchers who were busily studying their own people's genetic makeup. Over the years, they enlightened me on this subject in much the same way that I had gained an interesting perspective on Jewish history from Jewish chroniclers. The first thing I found was information on the set of genetically born diseases that occur almost exclusively in the Jewish community, such as Tay-Sachs disease. Their presence certainly indicated a genetic variant specific to the Jewish population and illustrated a genetic difference from the Gentiles, from all Gentiles. Soon I found scientific papers dealing precisely with the issues that I sought. Genetic researchers Sachs and Bat-Miriam discovered amazing similarity between the Jewish populations of 9 countries of North Africa, the Middle East, and Central Europe. Conversely, they found sharp differences between Jews and non-Jews from those same countries. In studying blood group data, Morant Kopek and Damashka Sovshkak, if that's the pronunciation, I may be at fault there, wrote in a book called The Genetics of the Jews that, quote, "It may be said in general, blood group data support the relative homogeneity of the main historical Jewish communities." Unquote. Now, here we have mainstream Jewish anthropologists and geneticists, the same groups who chronically preach to us that there are no great differences, say, between blacks and whites, to boldly assert that the Jewish people are genetically distinctive and relatively homogeneous. They argue that some differences exist between the Ashkenazim and the Sephardim, the main ethnic division among Jews, but that essentially Jews are a single people with a limited genetic resemblance to the European populations among whom they dwell. Some quotes and sources. In blood group data, 2 major studies, one in 1977 by Bonnie Tamir, Ashbel, and Knitt, and one by Carlin, Knitt, and Bon Tamir in 1979, found, when using 14 polymorphic loci, no significant difference in Jewish populations from Iraq, Libya, Germany, or Poland. They estimated that genetic distance between Gentiles and Jews living in the same area is 3 to 5 times greater than for Jews living in different nations studied. In the 1977 study, the researchers state not much admixture has taken place between Ashkenazi Jews and their Gentile neighbors during the past 700 years or so. And I can go on and on. I got three or four more studies. You can go to my print copy or my downloadable version and read about those and see the sources. I will again emphasize that these groups specifically say that Jewish populations are many times more different from their local Gentile populations than they are from Jews from different countries. One researcher summed up the overall genetic differences by saying that there was probably at least 3 times more genetic difference between an average Jew in France and his Gentile Frenchman neighbor than between an average French Jew and a Jew living in Russia or the Middle East. Now, these Jewish studies amaze me. I would not have guessed that Jews were that genetically different from all Europeans. I knew a few Jews who were indistinguishable from the potpourri of other European Americans. From their appearance, it seemed impossible that there was three times more genetic difference from us than from Jews in remote regions of the world. But the research proved that a wide genetic difference indeed existed between Jew and European. I wondered why they did not seem that dramatically different in their appearance. Fritz Lenz suggested back in the 1930s that Jewish resemblance to the European populations did not mean that their genes were similar. He suggested that their similar external resemblance could have emerged from a natural selection of genes within the Jewish gene pool. These genes could simply be a small cluster of genes that lay dormant in the Jewish pool or that were introduced by a limited genetic mixture with Gentiles, and which then were selectively favored in the social environment. Genes that caused a greater corporal resemblance to that of the Gentile host could have been very favorable results, had favorable results in the acceptance, accumulation of wealth, as well as social advancement, leading to productive success in Gentile societies. By a somewhat similar process, distinct species of butterflies, not closely related, come to resemble one another without narrowing their genetic distance. A very small set of genes influencing appearance within the Jewish population could thus be favored, causing a greater similarity of appearance to the Gentile population while not narrowing their overall genetic alienation from their host population. Over many generations, the external resemblance to Gentiles could increase while the parts of the brain that affect behavioral tendencies and abilities could thus be unaffected. According to evolutionary genetics, it is possible that Jews have come to more resemble their hosts in their external appearance while at the same time becoming even more distinct in their mental and behavioral characteristics. Whatever the questions of physical appearance, there seemed little doubt that Jews are indeed very different from Europeans and that they had maintained that genetic difference for a very long time. I also ran across a number of popular sources arguing that high Jewish-Gentile intermarriage rates would end their genetic distinctiveness from European Gentiles. And in so many other matters dealing with Jews, there's a wealth of information on this issue, an underlying reality that's quite different from some popular perceptions. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's the end of the first part of the 14th chapter of Jewish Supremacism, the spoken word edition of this book. I hope you're enjoying it, and I hope you remember that your support makes possible this book, my website, the David Duke Report, and my work all over the world. I'm very proud to say that nobody, I believe, does more to wake up the European people and the other peoples of the world to the perils of Jewish supremacism, the dangers that are inherent in this radical extremist philosophy, than I do. So I appreciate everything that you do to help make my work possible because I depend on you. Well, until tomorrow, thank you so much. God bless and take care.
This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.daviddude.com.